today's show is proudly sponsored by Minding the Gap. You guys all know that mental health for dancers matters. You're on board. You want to see the culture in your studio change, but where do you start? Enter Minding the Gap. Minding the Gap is dedicated to seeing mental health regarded with the same seriousness as physical health in dance culture, and they come armed with solutions. Whether it's helping you craft policies and procedures that protect the mental wellness of dancers and staff, consulting to build a robust mental health program in your school or company, or providing mental health skills workshops for your students and teachers, Minding the Gap has you covered. They bring the expertise of the best dance mental health experts in the world to you. For more information, visit www.wearemindingthegap.org or click the link in the show notes. Hello, dancers. Welcome back. I am so excited to be here today, and I'm just so filled with gratitude for this episode. I mean, 50 episodes. I had no idea when this all started that it would go this far, and I'm just filled today with so much happiness and gratitude that I've been able to publish 50 episodes of conversations that are just really dear to my heart. I've met the most amazing people, and I now have so much hope for the direction of the ballet world. And I'm so grateful to you all for sticking with me through 50 episodes. It could not have happened without you, and I'm just so, so grateful that you are still here with me week after week, listening and learning, and it's just been the best journey. It is therefore with great pride, gratitude, and excitement to present to you the one and only Biscuit Ballerina. Shelby Williams is a soloist with the Royal Ballet of Flanders and the creator of Biscuit Ballerina, a satirical ballet account that addresses unhealthy perfectionism and advocates for mental health awareness. Biscuit Ballerina has been featured in New York Times, Point Magazine, Dance Europe, and Dance Spirit, and Shelby has been nominated for Best Performance by a Female Dancer by Dance Europe magazine. It was such an honor to get some one-on-one FaceTime with the ballerina we all know, love, and can totally relate to. Her satirical Instagram and website not only crack us up, but they help us through those tough times of perfectionism and allow us space to laugh at ourselves. And if laughter is the best medicine, she has earned that MD. But before we throw it over to her, please remember that I am not a mental health professional, and anything you hear me say on the show is based on my personal experience and perspectives and should not be considered medical advice. By listening to the podcast, you agree not to use any of the content to diagnose you or anyone else of any mental or health condition. If any of the things shared on the show resonate with you, I encourage you to talk to your doctor or click the link in the show notes to find the best healthcare professional for you. And before we get started, I also want to mention that anything said on the podcast reflects my dance experience as a whole and not any one teacher, studio, or company. The opinions shared by my guests in this episode are their own and come from their individual viewpoint. Again, such a fun, informative, and exciting conversation with Shelby, and I cannot wait for you to hear it. So here you go. Hello, dancers. Welcome back. I am so excited to be celebrating our 50th episode anniversary. I don't know, is that a thing? Today with Shelby Williams. You know and love her as Biscuit Ballerina. Welcome, Shelby.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you so much for your time today. I know my listeners and I both are just so excited every time that you're on a live video or you do a talk or an interview, like everybody wants to hear what you have to say. So I'm really excited.
I'm really excited to talk to you. I love everything that you're doing with the podcast. So I'm really honored to be a part of it.
Thanks. All right. So let's dive right in. First of all, for like the one or two people out there who've never met you or don't know who you are, let's hear a brief overview of your relationship with ballet over time, And if it's something you feel comfortable with, I'd love to hear also what role your mental health has played throughout your dancing career.
So I think I followed a pretty typical route of a lot of aspiring ballerinas when I was a preteen and teenager. Then I went to summer intensives, and I eventually went to train year round, first at the Washington School of Ballet and then at Houston Ballet Academy. And that was actually first where I had started having to address my mental health. It started pretty early in my, before my career even started actually. And that was thanks to Houston Ballet Academy, that they actually had a sports psychologist that they referred students to when they were having a difficult time. Yeah, I think at the time they were the only school, dance, like ballet academy in the country that had a resource like that available to their students. And I basically had a sort of anxiety attack in ballet class one time, just staring at myself in the mirror, comparing myself to the other dancers in class. Adagio has always been my weak point. And so of course it happened in adagio that I was staring and my legs were like barely at 90 and everyone else had their legs higher. And then I started to have this kind of increased heart rate and feeling like I couldn't breathe. And of course, like tears welling up and feeling like it was really difficult to contain it. And I started crying while dancing. And of course that kind of freaked out my teacher, that they were just wondering, okay, everything, we're just doing class and suddenly she's crying. And the director of the school referred me to this sports psychologist, and we kind of found out that like a lot of dancers, I would suffer from anxiety and the pressure of expectations of perfectionism. Mm-hmm. Or being a perfectionist and expectations of perfection in ballet. And that's when I started having to learn how to address my own perfectionism in a career that demands perfection in many ways. From there, I went on to join the second company at Houston Ballet. And then I was an apprentice in Dresden Semperoper Ballet. That was how I made my transition over to Europe. And from there, I kind of jumped around at a few different companies in France and Spain and Germany before I landed in Antwerp 6 years ago. And I now dance as a soloist with the Royal Ballet of Flanders, also known as Opera Ballet Vlaanderen in the nice. Dutch name.
Yeah.
So that's where I am now, but definitely the mental health side of it started very early on, or I had to recognize it very early on.
Yeah. That's really, really interesting. So especially the adagio anxiety. I feel like that should be in the DCIM, like adagio specific anxiety, because I certainly had it.
But there's also another thing, and I think it also is maybe just people who feel like they're maybe not naturally flexible. I think everyone has probably their step that triggers them based on what they struggle with. Mm-hmm. And because I was never really flexible, it was always adagio or sometimes fondue. And still to this day, I joke with all my colleagues that I can tell the state of my mental health based on how I feel during a fondue exercise at bar.
Wow.
Because if I'm in a really unhealthy place, like maybe I'm way too stressed or I haven't been getting enough sleep and it's affecting my mood, I feel like I have the weight of the world on my quads in fondue. And that's like,
it just feels heavy and just can't move.
Everything feels heavy.
Yeah. I can completely relate to that. My issue was I was hypermobile. So not with a disorder, but like very flexible, but zero strength. And so like, sure, my leg could get up there, but I couldn't get it up there myself. And it certainly couldn't hold it there. I had a lot of like instability with balance and so forth. So like, that real panic in the middle of class, I've experienced that before. And my heart goes out to young Shelby in that moment, because I can totally relate to that.
Yeah. And I can imagine for dancers with hypermobility, the feeling of being out of control, wanting to be in control, and just your body not cooperating because of its extreme range of motion.
Just kind of doing its own thing.
Literally.
So interesting. It's so interesting how these mental health things play out in different ways for different people, you know? Yeah, it's really, really interesting. So coming to Biscuit Ballerina, I'd love to hear the genesis of it. Like, how did it start? What was the inspiration? What were your goals or your aims when you started it? And have those changed over time?
So at Biscuit Ballerina, again, it started back when I was in ballet school, and it definitely started as a coping mechanism, and there was never a plan to it or some sort of conscious decision to use it in some way. It was just my roommates and I at the school would, when we get home at the end of the day, and we were so exhausted, and we also maybe were not so satisfied with how we did in a variations class, or were stressed about evaluations coming up. While we were sewing pointe shoes, we would put them on before we broke them in or did anything to try and help them look better. And we would make videos of ourselves doing échappés with our feet just looking really bad. And we do just close up artistic videos of really bad footwork, being like, this is us in the raw, you know?
Yes.
I think it made us all feel better that we could find some sort of solidarity in our frustrations and our sense of kind of hopelessness that it's never going to be quite what we want it to be. And then I would just do that all the time with friends at work, once I was a professional as well. Other people were also very good at dancing in a very biscuity way, that it's kind of like when you imagine pointing your foot so hard all the time, and then it feels so good to flex just to do the opposite. It's the same, like you're concentrating on perfecting something so much all the time that it feels really good to just let loose and purposely do the opposite of everything and not think about it at all.
It's like mental health cross training.
Like feel a little bit goofy.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's kind of exactly what it is just to not be with like on such a focused route all the time working towards one thing. You can also goof off with it as well. So I would like my whole career, every company I went to, I think I've been in like 6 or 7 different companies, every company I had friends in the company who did the same thing. Like unknowingly, yes, we were using it as a coping mechanism for when we were annoyed or frustrated or bored or whatever it was, like something, if we weren't enjoying ourselves in the studio, we used it as a way to just let loose and get rid of all the pressures on us.
Yeah, it's really great.
Yeah, and then it kind of became a social media thing by mistake at the time that I made Biscuit Ballerina. I had never had a public Instagram account. I didn't even have a phone that could take quality video. So it happened because a colleague of mine took a video of me in a break in rehearsal. We were doing this creation with Edward Locke. He's a choreographer who used to be the director of La 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 Human Steps. And they're known for these dance films they made where it's super fast point work, super fast partnering. And you kind of feel like you never have time to finish any of the movements. So as a dancer, it can be really frustrating, especially at the beginning of a creation process, that you just think, I am not hitting a single nice position ever. And so that was one of those creation processes where I needed Biscuit Ballerina to help me get through my criticism of myself. And so I was doing, you know, like a little biscuit dance on my own in our 5-minute break during rehearsal. And my colleague recorded it and she put it on her Instagram. And then all these people started responding to it. And I didn't expect it to go a little bit viral on her page. And I was like, I guess other people not. Yeah, I was like, not just me and my weird friends, other people like it too. So I was like, I thought about it a couple of days and then I thought, maybe I'm gonna make it an Instagram account dedicated to this. And then all of my friends from ballet school and from the other companies who used to also just goof off with me, they would follow. And in my mind, I thought, and then maybe some people will send me their own videos and it'll be a little collection of us all dancing without thinking about any of our technique and just undoing everything. And I didn't really know how Instagram worked, in the sense like I didn't know what a hashtag was for. I just thought they were totally bizarre. So in a satirical way, I started putting hashtags that were like ballerina perfection, you know, like lines for days, all these things that I was not, not knowing that it would like attract people to it. I didn't realize algorithms did a thing where they bring you to certain videos. And I remember in like 2 weeks, it had something like 3,000 followers. And then overnight I got 1,000 more. And I, I thought, oh, this is weird. This seems like a lot of people, like what's happening? And then I realized Point Magazine had done an article on it that was like, who is this mystery dancer? Like, who's making us cringe so hard and we love it. And yeah, so that was kind of like the start of the social media aspect of it. But it was only after it got some attention from press, like Dance Magazine and Point Magazine wrote about it, that I realized I needed to probably better explain what I was doing, because I could very much understand how people would see it and think it's imitating other people rather than imitating myself and how I feel and undoing things that I'm working on so that I can relax. So then that's sort of when it started to have more of a mission, was at that point where I realized, oh, I need to explain what this is, that this is a chance to take ballet's perfection off a pedestal and make it not so important, and realize that you should just enjoy what you're doing. And it's also okay to be goofy with it or to not always do things well. We all have moments where we don't look good. So I put up, also I started putting up a couple pictures of when I didn't look so good on stage, like
those great shots that are like between transition steps.
Or maybe not even between transition steps. I definitely have pictures of myself on stage where it should be a good photo, and I just I just did not shape my feet or did not straighten my knee. So like first sharing stuff of myself to show other people, okay, who I am. I'm a professional dancer, but I'm also very much imperfect. And this is me kind of celebrating being imperfect and indulging in imperfection, finding it as a relaxing and fun and beautiful and uplifting thing. And then other people started sending in their falling videos or their really bad photos. And so that's essentially where the concept of everything came from, that it's partially me diving into this caricature of myself, trying to love and enjoy dance, putting some satire in there with like a ballet diva perspective from time to time, then mixed with submissions from other followers who send in their own photos and videos.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I mean, I'm loving all of this because, like I had said before, you know, mental health cross-training. But, you know, at the same time, I think a lot of people have found a very similar release that you have through, just not taking yourself so seriously. Taking the work seriously, because it is serious work, you know, like you have to work really hard in this industry to be successful and to, you know, achieve certain goals and things like that. But if you're taking yourself that seriously all the time, pretty soon it's going to catch up with you, I think.
It can suck the joy out of it when you dance with blinders on for too long, I think, where you're too focused only on the serious aspect of something. And I like what you said. I think it's very true that it doesn't mean, just because you don't always take yourself seriously, doesn't mean you don't take the art form seriously. You can still be very respectful of the art form and of other artists in the space and everything it has given you, but you can also poke fun at everything it has taken away from you. Like sometimes it takes away, you know, your pride when you see yourself not looking good, but you can laugh it off then instead.
Yeah. It must be really healing too, because I don't know, for me personally, I can only, you know, speak from my own experience, but you know, those moments when you're at the bar and, you know, not in front of the best mirror or, you know, and you're just going through.
Everyone knows the best mirror in the studio. You know, everyone knows like what mirror you don't want to stand in front of, because it's just going to kill your self-confidence.
Yeah. Yeah. And inevitably you get stuck there one day, you know, but I think this type of satirical coping method can maybe be a little bit skill building for us, so that in those moments when we're in front of the bad, quote, bad mirror, or just having an off day, you know, we can look at that, and instead of making that laundry list of like why we hate ourselves or why we hate our bodies, you know, we can look at that and go, this would make a fantastic Instagram post. Yeah, it's hilarious.
Right?
And tomorrow will be different. Or if I go one mirror over, it looks different. Or, you know, whatever the thing is, it sounds like it's probably really healing for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think one of the things I love the most is when I get messages from dancers who write saying how it has been so healing for them and it's changed their relationship with dance or with ballet in particular. And I'll never forget, there was one dancer who her school was performing at the Kennedy Center, and it was a huge deal. And in the middle of the show, she had this pas de deux and she just fell, and she fell hard. And she sent me the video and she said, I would have cried, except instead my first thought was, I can send this into Biscuit Ballerina for Falling Friday. And I thought that was so nice that it took what would have been probably a very upsetting moment into something that she was like, there's something good that will come of this. And that is that can be part of like a compilation that's going to make a lot of people laugh.
Yeah. And I talk a lot on the show too about, you know, focusing on the process and not your end results necessarily, that, you know, you spend 90% of your lifetime as a dancer in the studio and about 10% of it on stage. So although those performances are wonderful and great, and that's what we work towards, that's not the life of a dancer.
No, not at all. And that's, I'm so glad you say that, because that is exactly what my psychologist worked with me on when I was a student, was dealing with the fact that, or accepting the fact that you cannot put all of your happiness on the achievements. Like, you can't depend on the achievements to feel good. It's the process that you have to enjoy. Otherwise, it's not sustainable, because the achievements are so fleeting. And then what does that mean for your mood on the in-between moments, which is the majority of our career?
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I think this type of coping mechanism really kind of helps with that too, because like your dancer said, like I could have obsessed over it and been devastated, and I'm sure she was disappointed, but you know, her first thought was like, this is going to be hilarious. Yeah. You know, like, that's great.
Yeah.
That's really fun. So you kind of mentioned that, you know, you didn't really have much of a mission with Biscuit Ballerina when it started, but it's sort of evolved over time. Talk a little bit about, you know, what Biscuit Ballerina is doing now and how that kind of is a little bit more directed.
Yeah. So first it started just becoming more directed by me explaining it a little bit. And then as it grew, I saw the possibilities that it presented, because it ended up having such a large following. And I started first by doing a blog that I wanted to interview mostly people I knew that either I'd trained with or I'd worked with at one point or another, who went on to be very successful dancers, like principal dancers in companies all around the world, but who I knew were willing to be very honest about their process to get to where they are today, and talk about how where they are today is also not perfect, or they themselves are still not perfect, even if they're a principal dancer in some national company somewhere. And so I started with a blog asking very simple questions, because it was things that I thought, even still as an adult, I would love to hear from other dancers. We don't talk about it. We're very good at putting up a facade, because I think a lot of times it's considered that if you are vulnerable and you do talk too much about the things you struggle with in dance, you can be written off as just not strong enough for the industry. You know, like mentally not strong enough. It's something that requires discipline and a thick skin. So, and luckily I had these friends who were very much willing to answer the questions and answer them in a very thorough and genuine way. And it was things like just asking, you know, like, what injuries have you had? How is that to come back? What sort of maybe mental setbacks have you had? Do you still deal with them? How do you cope with them? And that was what I did for a while, until the pandemic started. And then again, like opportunity presented itself. So many people were at home and had the time. And I just started asking a bunch of people, would you want to do a similar format, but in video? So it gives some people something to watch during the day and maybe could be a bit educational for younger dancers who are stuck at home and feeling demoralized by the fact that they can't be doing their training at a time that they're, you know, supposed to be working towards a certain level they want to get so that they can get their first contract. And started doing that with dancers. And then luckily, Terry Hyde, who is a psychotherapist from the UK, and he is the owner of Counseling for Dancers, that's his brand. He reached out to me wanting to collaborate on some things. And we had already done a few blog posts together exchanging. I wrote for his blog, he wrote for mine. And then I had him do a video interview as well. And then that just led to other people, other maybe people in nutrition, but finding healthier approaches to nutrition that's not obsessive the way dancers can be obsessive about nutrition.
Or
just also talking about different themes. Like I had Phil Chan, who wrote the book Final Bow for Yellow Face, talk and do a webinar also along with Georgina. The two of them started it.
Yep.
It's Georgina Paskogan. So just touching on different themes. Memoirs of Flax and Ballet, also doing a whole series with them. And it was just nice thinking about, okay, I started this to talk about kind of mental health in a way and find some humor in it and help people laugh off the tough bits. But then I thought it's also nice to use the platform to discuss other things that definitely have room for improvement.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I mean, it's so great that you've been able to transform what started out as laughing at yourself, essentially, and your friends laughing at themselves into a platform that's really changing people's perspectives and making real change in the dance world. It's really exciting.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's definitely a challenge sometimes. You realize that, you know, social media, people have a certain limited attention span. And so it's definitely a matter of also balancing the type of content you put out there and you know, not getting too much on a soapbox too often about, we can make the dance world a better place. Like,
I feel you, trust me.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Well, I would love to also kind of talk to you about, I know you've done some talks on perfectionism before, but I'd love to hear what perfectionism means to you specifically, because I feel like people can define it differently within the context of their own experience, and how you deal with it, other than the humor, obviously, how you deal with that on a daily basis.
So it's definitely something that I have to continue to check in on. It's not like, oh, I addressed it once and I realize I'm a total perfectionist and now I'm never upset by it. I still definitely get upset with myself due to my expectations. And so it's kind of reminding myself to practice what I preach. And if I talk about, you know, we have to find ways to find balance in our life to counterbalance the focus on our work, it'll be when I start to feel myself, maybe over the course of a week or two, several times I'm getting stuck in this perfectionist mentality that's getting me agitated at work, I will push myself to do more things outside of work with people not associated with work, just do something completely different. Or also a big thing that helps me is when I start to get upset with how something's going, is just to completely step away from it. As far as like, if I'm working on a certain movement quality in a solo or something, and I feel like it's not good and I'm getting really harsh on myself, I will say like, okay, I'm not gonna work on that solo for the movement. I'm going to go through the emotional state it's supposed to be in, or what is the context of this moment, and brainstorm what are different mental approaches I could take as a character or embodiment of something on stage, and just changing the focus to a different aspect of the work definitely helps me stay motivated and curious. And then usually in that I get in a flow that I can go back into correcting the other things, but I'm not so easily upset by them anymore. But it's continuous. It's not something like, oh, there's, I figured out the source of my perfectionism and now I never have to think about it ever again.
Gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, things like this are not, it's not a surgical process where you can go in and remove the piece that's sort of clogging up the machine and then it's all better.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I mean, it would be nice if that were a thing, but.
Yeah.
But again, we're talking about process, not result, right? So even working through any mental health challenges that you have, you know, that process, you end up learning so much more about yourself and maybe even about your colleagues or friends or family through the process rather than just like, okay, let's fix it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. And it's also nice to kind of remind yourself also, I think, to be curious when approaching dance, not necessarily having specific goals, but it's also good to go in with a sense of, I wonder what I'm going to discover today. Not today, I want to, you know, get a triple pirouette, or today I want to do this, but go in with the idea of, there's so many aspects to dance, I wonder what's going to change in my dancing today, and allow yourself to be satisfied with any aspect of it and let that satisfaction carry you forward to push through maybe struggles in the next day.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And, you know, I think I sort of have adopted this is kind of carried over the similar mindset into teaching, because of course you have a curriculum and of course you have a syllabus and you have goals for your students to achieve by the end of the semester or whatever the period is. Or if they have, you know, a test or a competition or something. But also going into class every day with that curiosity of like, I wonder what my students need today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, sure, we might be focusing on their port-a-bras or, you know, whatever the thing is. But also having that flexibility of mind saying, well, maybe we don't get to XYZ exercise today because they need, you know, ABC first or whatever the thing is.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I think that's a really easily transferable skill into all aspects of the dance space, not just as the performer or the professional dancer, but teachers, choreographers, leadership even, you know.
Definitely.
Like, I think that that's really useful tool for sure.
Definitely. Definitely. So, I think it's something that can also, like this year or 2 years ago at the start of the pandemic, with extra time, I just started doing some college courses again, and I'm working towards a bachelor's in management. And it's been so interesting for me learning about contemporary approaches to management. And basically every course I'm taking is teaching, like, if you just make a plan and stick to it and don't change anything or adapt along the way, like, this is for sure not going to be the most productive route. And everything in the business world is talking about every day you need to reevaluate the situation and ask, is this the best approach for today? And I feel like dance could be a little bit more like that I think sometimes we just push through and we see, you know, the end goal and you try to make a beeline to it, but the fastest route might actually be something with a few curves.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. So the ways that overcome's not really the right word, because like you said, it's like a constant process, but the way you deal with perfectionism, do you feel like it's changed as you've matured and gotten more experienced in your career?
I do feel like, I think you could even say gotten over, because there are definitely aspects of my dancing that I would be critical of that today I'm not so critical of. So there are things that I think with time, they sort of melt away. And that came from also watching other people on stage and seeing what reads and realizing, you know, it's not always the dancer with the best technique that moves me or that I wanna see again. Or it's not always the dancer who has the best body that's the most beautiful person to look at on stage, or, you know, it's so much of it comes from what you can emote and how genuine you can be on stage. And the audience feels that. The audience feels when you're being very human versus when there's something forced.
Yes. The vulnerability is not there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and even in contemporary work where maybe it's not necessarily doesn't have to be human, but something where it's coming from, I feel like from watching, I can see when the way someone's working is coming from a healthier place or an unhealthy place. And so then that also made me realize sometimes when I tried to just, you know, muscle through or force through things previously, I wouldn't do that now. I would say, you know, that's not pleasant for someone to watch. They want to see me at ease or enjoying something on stage. So I'm going to approach it slightly differently. Maybe it's, in my mind, it would have originally been less impressive, but I know from now experience, witnessing enough people on stage, it's actually probably going to be more enjoyable for the audience and also more enjoyable for me.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've told students, you know, like my more advanced students this before, in that, or if I'm choreographing or something, that the audience, they don't take ballet class every day.
No.
The vast majority of them have never been in a studio before or have very little experience with ballet. And yes, you know, the really impressive jumps or, you know, the multiple turns and the quote tricks, I guess you could call them. Yes, they're crowd pleasing for, you know, 1 second, right? But if you're able to connect with them and to do your real job, which in my view is to communicate with your audience, not to perform, then you are making a lasting impact. You're pulling an emotion out of yourself and giving it to them, and then they're feeling it. And that is what's going to have a lasting impact.
Yeah,
that's
definitely
what's going to make them take a second look and say, well, maybe I am a ballet fan and want to come back.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's and support the art form and push it forward, or take their child to ballet class, you know, who's been begging for months. And then they get it, you know. Those are the things that push our art form forward, not the fleeting thrill of, you know, 5 or 6 pirouettes on the left side en dedans en pointe, you know, or whatever it is.
I think it's also worth reminding ourselves sometimes is that people come to the theater to be moved or to feel something, to maybe be presented with something that makes them consider things and question things. There's so many reasons why people come to the theater. They might want to be kind of wowed, but I think the main motivator is wanting to be moved and to feel something. And it's very different than going to the circus, for example. A lot of people go see circus because of the tricks. Not that there isn't very artistic circus productions that also can do the same thing, but it's just historically theater productions,
expectations.
The reason you go is for to feel something. And I think that's important to remember. And the thing you said about like most of the audience doesn't know anything about dance or ballet. They've never stepped foot inside of a studio. I have to say, like, something that was very, very reassuring was I have a brother. He's 1 year older than me. The poor guy has been dragged to every Nutcracker under the sun.
Me too. I have an older brother too. Now he's married to a former dancer and they have 2 daughters. So
I know.
Well,
he like, I think that like so many siblings of dancers, they're dragged to like every production, every recital. And then of course, if you also pursue it as a profession, because they're your family, they got to support you. They're going to come see some shows. And, My brother has seen so many shows, and I would think at this point, like, he is an expert in dance. He knows some of the terminology, and he saw a video of Biscuit Ballerina once, and he wrote me, and he said, "What's wrong with this dancing?" He just, like, he saw it, and he thought it still looked kind of cool, and he was like, I kind of get the sense that there's maybe something funny about it, but I think it still looks pretty good. Like, wow, okay, that takes a lot of the pressure off of me of like, you were more informed than the average audience member, and you think this
I still think
so
that's fantastic. I love that so much. You know, it's really interesting. My husband is not a dancer. He's a scientist. Like he's not in the dance world at all. Never has been. In fact, his first live performance was this past winter. He took me to the Nutcracker. It was the first time he'd ever seen it.
Oh wow!
You know, yeah, it was really cool. Actually, the first show he ever saw that was professional dance was he bought me a subscription to. I'm in Philadelphia, so Philadelphia Ballet, we support them. Shout out Philadelphia Ballet.
my former roommate is now their resident choreographer. So shout out to Giuliano.
Kidding. Yeah. All right. Nice.
I have to get over there to see a show sometime.
Yeah, for sure. So during the pandemic, my husband, as a surprise, bought me their spring subscription to their virtual season that they were running. Oh, nice. And it was really cool because we sat on the sofa and, you know, we had some snacks and had this experience that you could never have in the theater where, like, after one of the pieces was over, it was like a gala type presentation, you know, with multiple different styles and pieces. And we would pause it and we would talk about it.
Oh, how nice.
It was so cool. And of course, there's nothing that can replace live dance, you know, like being, you know, in the theater. But I will say, we got an opportunity for him to go, okay, so what was that guy doing? And what did this mean? And sometimes the answer was, well, what do you think it meant? Like, what did it mean to you? You know, And we got to have such a great, really cool conversation real time as the show was going along without missing anything. It was really, really exciting and so interesting. And I mean, I'm very jealous of people who've never seen dance.
Yeah, same.
Because like they can watch it without this perfectionism, this eye of saying, oh, that corps de ballet line is not together, or they are like 2 inches off center, or, you know, whatever those intrusive thoughts might be. I'm so jealous of those people who can look at dance for what it truly is and take that layer of perfection away.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same. I love when I when I have friends and family come who are non-dance people and they see a show and then I always ask them after what they think. And luckily a lot of my friends and family, they're very honest. Like they will also tell me things they didn't like and things that I thought went so badly in a show did not bother them at all.
Didn't read at all.
Yeah. And also I love also what you said when you kind of asked your husband sometimes, like, well, what did it mean to you? That is for me as an artist, the most rewarding thing to hear what people got from shows, even if it's not maybe what I was thinking of, if it connected to them in some personal way, that it told a story that they could relate to. I love seeing that.
Yeah. Or if they didn't get it, if they couldn't connect to it, but then they had to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like even that is fascinating, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
This is why I love ballet right here, guys. This is it. So we've touched a little bit on, you know, teachers, and I know you're doing some courses in leadership right now for business. So I think that might be really interesting into this question. Do you have any advice or, you know, I hate telling people to give advice because it seems like so pressure filled, you know, like,
yeah.
But I would really like to talk about leadership in whatever form that takes, teacher, choreographer, admin, artistic director, but to help their students through perfectionism and or, you know, providing safer spaces to deal with perfectionism and not allow it to sort of overgrow the studio. Because I feel like it, you know, it's kind of a virus. It spreads, you know, from one student to the other.
Yeah, I think one of the first things is maybe not specific only to dealing with perfectionism and helping students cope with expectations, but just in general, I think a great thing that perhaps more dance teachers or directors could incorporate is making sure conversations are two-way conversations. I think there's definitely a hierarchical system in the ballet world in every context, in a company, in a school, and there's a whole culture of discipline. And so I think a lot of discussions end up being directors or teachers speaking at dancers and not speaking with them, because dancers are often scared to share something and maybe say, you know, it could be something as simple as, yeah, you always tell me this correction, but I don't really understand what you mean. And that's something that's preventing a dancer from moving forward. It just needs to be phrased in another way. Or also maybe a dancer sharing, you know, I deal with anxiety right before I go on stage and I don't know how to calm myself, and it's why I panic on stage, you know. So making sure conversations are definitely two-way conversations, and that way you can get to the root of things and help someone progress, rather than maybe with good intentions always throwing things their way that you think will, you know, little corrections or bits of advice, thinking, okay, this is gonna fix it and I don't know why. But if they don't feel open and comfortable enough to really share what's going on with you, it's gonna make it that much harder for you to help them.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, and this whole idea of, you know, leave it at the studio door, you know, come in without, well, that's dumb.
Yeah.
I mean, it's first of all not possible. It's like telling someone not to think of the word pink elephant. Like, that's all they're going to think about. Yeah. You know, you tell someone not to think of something, that's what they're going to focus on. So first of all, it doesn't work. And second of all, you know, it's really important that we're making safe spaces for dancers to flourish, whether they're young or whether they're at the beginning of their career or they're about to retire. Like, it doesn't matter what stage they're in their career, but that's the only way that artistic connection with the audience that we were just talking about can really flow, because without that safety feeling of being able to be vulnerable, like, how can you be vulnerable with your audience if you can't be vulnerable in the studio?
Exactly. Yeah. And another thing I also think that has to do with vulnerability in the studio, it's maybe more with commercial dance, jazz, hip hop studios inspired by Millennium Dance Complex and things. So maybe not so prevalent in ballet studios, but also prevalent in the way that people will linger in ballet and videotape themselves doing pirouettes and things, and kind of the boom that social media has had from, I would call it like dance porn, like just like people like wanting to see like tricks and close-up videos of like really cool movements zoomed in and out while the person's
just like
dancing.
The hyperextended foot going over the point shoe.
Like a really high demi-point releve in slow motion and like that sort of stuff. That I think maybe a lot of people underestimate how much that affects their students or their dancers' comfort with being vulnerable in the studio. I've definitely noticed like over the several years, because I teach quite often. And I think over the last 10 years, I've seen a significant change in how much dancers are willing to try and fail in the studio. And realizing that a lot of dancers don't want to show their imperfections in the studio because they'd rather show them off online where they can curate it. They can film it a million times and put up the best take, where if you're in the studio in the middle of class, you can't only show your best take. Everyone's going to see all the times you try. And yeah, I just noticed over time, you know, when I give a correction in class, it used to be that students would all be trying at the same time. And now it's just a lot of standing there and nodding. Not trying it. And then, you know, they're going to maybe try it privately on their own after. And if they get a good clip of it, then they're going to share it so that people can see what they learned or what they did. So I think maybe teachers can be very careful about how social media or video is used in their studio, or remind their students, like, this is a space, like, no one's judging you based on what's happening in class today right here. This is your safe space to fail, because without failure, we don't learn.
Right. So curious, I assume your students are aware that you're the Biscuit Ballerina, yes?
Yeah.
I mean, how can they not be?
Yeah.
Do you feel like that just the notion of you curating this culture of satire and, you know, not taking yourself too seriously, what we were talking about earlier, do you feel like that provides a safer space for them? Like,
I would hope so.
Potentially?
I would hope so. But I honestly think if you spend the whole year in a normal environment, like all dance studios being influenced by other teens around you, that everyone has the same desire to always look their best and curate their social media so that people outside also only see their best. I think just having to be a person who makes fun of trying to be perfect and who tells you them like, oh yeah, like we're not here to be perfect. We're here to play with it and see what comes of our dancing. I don't think I can make it totally go away.
Well, sure. Yeah. You're only one person.
Yeah. in their class, but I would hope, I hope it does make them relax a little bit. I find that the more I let myself mess up while I'm showing things and laugh about it, or the more I also like maybe show an example of like, now this is what we all are gonna tend to do, and we gotta think like not to do it. And maybe if I do like a little biscuit step, being like, this is something we all do at some point, then it really helps them like focus on that when they do the combination, because it sticks in their memory. But two, I think it also helps them relax into the effort, you know, that the effort isn't something filled with tension, but the effort is something fueled by a joy for dance.
Yeah. Oh, that's so fun. I mean, I'd love to be a 14-year-old in your class.
I would love to be a 14-year-old again. As much as I love having guest teachers, and I really adore, like in our company here, we have some amazing guest teachers who come through. There's something about being like at the start of your pre-professional training where everything is so magical. I would love to experience that moment again of like every single professional dancer who came through and taught a class. I was just like so starstruck. And that would be a really nice feeling to feel again, because it's just like
the idea that I remember like the first time I met Julie Kent, like I just broke down and started sobbing. And she was like, "Are you okay?" I was like, "I'm fine. I just love you. You're great."
It's such a magical age, because it's like you have the whole world is in front of you, and there's like all the potential. And I remember I had like on my mirror at home in my bathroom, I'd like there was a thing where you could do with like t-shirt paint, but if you would like paint it onto like aluminum foil or something, it would dry. You could stick it on a mirror, like it would turn into like
a decal.
And I definitely made one in glitter glue that said like American Ballet Theater, and then I'm
sure you did.
It was like up on my mirror until maybe 5 years ago when I went home and I was like, this thing's got to come down. Like, I don't work for that company.
So. Right. they're not writing the checks.
Right
now.
Are you so nice?
Yeah, I definitely.
Aspirations are limitless when you're that young.
Yeah. So talking about that, before I let you go, I have two really fun lighter questions, and I think we're at the perfect spot for the first one. So I'm going to send you my time machine back to 14-year-old Shelby.
Yes.
And I'd love to hear what advice you would give to her.
The advice I would give Shelby is, when you panic, don't try to be like other people. That's not going to help you dance better or look better. When you panic, just relax and enjoy what you're doing, because then your natural talent will come out. Mm. I think that's definitely something I had to learn with time, is trying to dance like someone else because I thought that's what the school wanted to see. Mm-hmm. Was fighting against my own strengths to try and mimic someone else's strength.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I love that. That's great. All right, so now I'm going to give you my magic wand.
Okay.
Tiara optional. And you get to wave it just once, and you get to change one aspect of the ballet world. What would it be?
I would get rid of all aesthetic expectations, whether it be what the body should look like, what color the person should be, what gender, boys can't dance this, girls can't dance that. I would get rid of any of the aesthetic expectations.
I love that. and that covers a lot of those bases.
But there's so many amazing things. I was talking to someone recently about just the dance norm and the standards that were set by I don't know who. Someone said like
old this white is dudes,
old white dudes ago. this is what a ballerina looks like, or this is this person's role,
right?
And I said, you know, dance it can be like science. You know, you don't science it's not a competition. It's not that the Olympics that, okay, we need to categorize people because then we're going to be really, you know, timing things and seeing how they compare to one another. It's not a competition. It is something that collectively as a society, we want to see it progress, and we want to see all these wonderful things that can come of it. And so in science, if you like kept people out of the lab, think of how many discoveries you would miss out on. And I think dance and ballet is the same. Like if you try to keep people out of it, think of all of the amazing artists that we would miss out on.
Yeah. Yes. And interpretations of roles too, existing roles, you know.
Yeah.
I'm loving some of these companies that are taking classical ballets and flipping the gender roles, or just like removing them all together. And, you know, we're getting these amazing interpretations of characters that we would never have seen before.
Exactly. And they're things that are also so much more relatable because it relates more to the world that's around us today, not the world that was happening 200 years ago.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, I love that so much. Good stuff. Good stuff. All right. Before I let you go, of course, share with everyone where they can find you and connect with you. If you have any special things coming up, would love to hear all that stuff.
Okay. So you can find me on Instagram at Biscuit Ballerina for all of my perfectionist humor type content. For my normal work content where it's a little bit more serious, you can find me at Shelby Grooves. Then I also have my website, biscuitballerina.com, where I'll typically put updates about maybe events that are happening, if I'm teaching around during the summer, or if we're having some sort of live video coming up. And I do have a series coming up later in spring that will be a new round of Dance Talks with Biscuit Ballerina. And the Dance Better podcast will be one of the guests for one of those talks. Yeah. And so we'll have a few others, and it'll be weekly for about 4 or 5 weeks. So I'm looking forward to sharing that with you all.
Yes, me too. I'm very excited. And as always, listeners, I'll plug all of the links where you can connect with Shelby in the show notes and get you connected with her. So thank you again for hanging out with me and spending this 50th episode with me. I'm so grateful for your time. It's been really, really fun.
It's been a blast. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Wow. I mean, what more can I say? Amazing. I knew it was going to be amazing. I thought it was amazing as it was happening. And I'm in awe. It was great. What a fun 50th episode. And big giant thank you to Shelby for her time and for chatting with me about perfectionism, because as you all know, that's one of the biggest issues right now in talking about mental health in the dance space, is that perfectionism. Just a few takeaways that I had. Reminding yourself that perfectionism recovery is an everyday thing. It's something we're always working on. It's never going to be finished. It's not something that you just do and it's done. And even Shelby has to remind herself of that from time to time. And I think that's really important because, you know, we might have periods of time where it seems easier or we don't even notice it. And then other times when, you know, we're having a bad day and or a bad couple of weeks, and those feelings of perfectionism and negative self-talk can really creep up on you. So I think that's a really, really good reminder and kind of gives us all a little bit of grace in understanding that it's a process. Also, taking the work seriously, taking your training seriously, taking your job seriously, but not taking yourself so seriously. I think that that skill in compartmentalizing the self from the work is so important. That yes, we have to pour ourselves into the work and pour our emotions into the work in order to communicate effectively on stage and have that vulnerability. But at the same time, when things don't go well, it's so good to sort of separate yourself from it and go, I am not a bad person because I failed to land my triple pirouette or wasn't super happy with that performance. I'm not a bad person. That was just not a great moment. And sometimes, honestly, they're funny. It may not work for everybody, but I know for me, being able to laugh at myself when I make a mistake is, it sort of breaks the tension. It breaks that cycle of negativity and brings some levity to the situation. And I just love, love, love what Biscuit Ballerina is doing. Also, I think she talked a little bit about how she's able to kind of snap herself out of that cycle. In moments where she's like kind of fixating on one thing and just can't get it right, and she's kind of spiraling, that she decides to sort of switch gears, whether it's on a different aspect of her technique, whether it's on a different aspect of her performance quality, something that in the character that she would like to work on. I think that's a really interesting approach because I know a lot of times we do get stuck in that hamster wheel, and then it's almost like you're building muscle memory to do the thing wrong. But if you're able to sort of switch your focus and then come back to it tomorrow or in a couple of days, I think that can be really helpful too. So many practical things that we talked about today, aside from all the inspirational stuff too. And I hope that you guys enjoyed it. I'm sure you did. It really was an exhilarating show for me to record. And I want to thank you all for listening today. I hope you enjoyed. And if you did, please go ahead and leave me a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, follow the pod on Spotify, and share it with just 3 friends to get the word out. And as always, if you have any questions, particular topics you'd like me to cover, or guests you'd like to hear from, you can email those to me at dancebetterpodcast@gmail.com, or you can hit me up on Instagram at dancebetterpodcast. Thank you so much for listening today, you all. I cannot wait to learn with you on the next episode. Bye!